All right, good morning. This is Amit Marwaha, Director of Investor Relations and Finance at Telarian. It's the week of November 26, 2018, and today I'm joined by the Chairman of Telarian, Sherif Sukhi. Good morning, Sherif.
Good morning, Amit.
Over the last couple of weeks, we've been fortunate enough to see a large portion of our shareholder base, both in the Northeast and Texas. You were along the ride with us with a large number of these meetings. We had a bunch of feedback and discussion in many of the meetings. It was quite lively. Wanted to take some time to sit down with you and gather some of your thoughts here and share some of the key takeaways from those meetings. So I guess to kick it off, what were the most important factors you think to concentrate on following the discussions and the meetings that we had, in your opinion?
Well, Amit, I think the first thing that I would want to say is that this is not a simple process. It's complicated. We've been at it over 3 years now, building very methodically what we think is a good value proposition for customers around the world, including in the United States. And the energy business is becoming more and more complicated and complex. There is a tremendous amount of pressure from a lot of different places that affect pricing and affect pricing mechanisms. This is not a simple investment proposal. Never has been, but it is becoming increasingly complex. And in this context, LNG is probably one of the most complicated issues in the energy complex, because the model is in transition from a traditional point-to-point market, including pricing mechanism that were appropriate at the time, whether it was indexed to oil or indexed to Henry Hub as a second generation, to something that is transitioning towards a true commodity business. In this context, it's hard to know what to concentrate on, and let me give you a simplification of what are the most important elements that I would focus on. First and foremost, fundamentals. If the price in Asia, where most of the demand is coming from, is significantly higher than the price in the United States, then there is an arbitrage that you can capture. And today you have Asian prices at $10, American prices on a long-term basis, although not for the very short month, at $3, and the arbitrage is absolutely there. And you add to this two very important factors on the demand side, particularly China and India are on a regular basis increasing their expected demand for natural gas, given the constraint that they have on pollution and growth into their own markets. And at the same time, the United States is blessed into being the position that we have an abundance of gas to the point where it's becoming a liability because we don't know what to do with. And internally, we have established that over the next 5 years, there's approximately 20 BCF of gas in the United States that will come either in associated form in the in the Permian Basin, SCOOP/STACK, Bakken, that have no market and are dependent largely on oil prices, plus the very cheap Marcellus gas and various other basins that will create an overflow of natural gas that we have to get rid of. In that context, you have high demand, and high supply, and we happen to be one of the low-cost providers, so we're in very good position as a country to be able to take advantage of this arbitrage. The second thing, Amit, that I would focus on after fundamentals is costs. And 60% of your cost is liquefaction cost. It is critical today to have a contractor who will deliver a project on time and on budget at an attractive price. And in today's world, contractors are now telling us, "We choose you. You don't choose us anymore." Because enough contractors have gotten themselves into very difficult situations by getting into projects that were not well conceived and have underbid the projects, and now the chickens are coming home to roost. So in that context, having a reliable contractor that gives you a price that you can rely on is critical. And we have Bechtel that have confirmed a lump sum turnkey contract at $550 a ton. And that is extremely valuable for us. Mm-hmm. The third thing to focus on is what is the size of the opportunity. Given global prices and our cost structure that we have very high degree of confidence is, we are fighting for an $8 billion EBITDA pool within 5 to 6 years of starting construction. Of that $8 billion, $2 billion will go to the banks and the financial institutions in order to finance the debt part of the project. And okay, the rest is left for the equity. And with $6 billion, our target at Tellurian is to keep $2.5 billion for the Tellurian shareholders.
So let's revisit those numbers again. You said the total cash available on the project for us is roughly $8 billion.
Yes. And $2 billion will go for financial counterparties.
Okay.
And $6 billion will be for the equity.
Got it.
And the equity, we are hoping and we are targeting that $2.5 billion of that equity will remain for Tellurian shareholders.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for clarifying. Let's dig into, I guess, two of the points that you discussed so far. Let's start off with the fundamentals. We've gone, obviously, from a oversupplied market to a tight market. Now you've seen this move in crude over the last, I guess, month or so. Do you think that materially shifts the outlook on the LNG side in terms of the growth there going forward, in your opinion, or what that does to netbacks, JKM prices?
Absolutely not, because you can't judge a 20-year demand picture on what happened in the last 3 months. I think we have to accept the fact that we are going to be in a volatile market, that weather will have a very significant impact. Geopolitics will play an important role. So you always have to be in a situation that is more defensive than you would have been 10 years ago, 5 years ago. However, in that context, you also have a growth in demand in China and in India particularly, but also in the rest of the world, that is irreversible because natural gas is critical to avoid pollution issues in both those countries.
Okay. What's your take here on this ENN deal at Freeport? Do you think at all this marks some type of an inflection point in terms of Chinese demand or offtake from the U.S.? Going forward, or what's your interpretation of it?
I think ENN has sent a strong indication that they're very comfortable with the supply picture in the United States and that they can afford to buy a contract that will effectively cost them Henry Hub plus $3.50 to $4. Mm-hmm. And on that basis, they have made a 20-year investment and a 20-year commitment. And in the overall scheme of things, given their customer base in China, this is a good transaction for them.
Do you think at all, is there any read-throughs to what this means for Chinese demand out of the U.S. going forward? Is it too early to say what this does, or do we have to wait to see how the tariff-related concerns and issues play out?
No, I think that on a global basis, there is no such thing as Chinese demand from the U.S.
Okay.
There is simply Chinese demand.
Mm-hmm.
And Chinese will pay JKM-based prices in the not-too-distant future,
mm-hmm.
plus whatever other burdens they want to put in China. But the global price on the water will be related to JKM, and everybody will pay that price. Then after that, if China wants to put tariffs or burdens on their own consumption domestically, that's entirely their business. It will not affect JKM prices.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about or dig into the EPC related costs there and how to think about that. You've seen more and more concerns coming out with regards to EPC providers, the cost overruns. You're seeing some pressure now on their debt, them having to raise financing that appears to be relatively expensive. Can you talk a bit about the state of the EPC providers out there, what the markets are not fully appreciating, or there seems to be a growing appreciation or the risk associated with choosing an EPC provider that can provide a project that is, at the costs outlined and can deliver it on time. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Certainly. So when Cheniere Energy proposed Sabine Pass, they proposed a $500 a ton contract with Bechtel to advance a project that was a brownfield project where the jetties and the storage tanks had already been constructed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lump sum turnkey contract for the delivery of a number of trains, five trains now, as the fifth train is coming. And Cheniere has the merit of being the only company that has developed projects on time, on budget, at that $500 a ton. Shortly thereafter, Sempra proposed Cameron and said that Chicago Bridge and Iron had guaranteed them a $450 a ton contract,
mm-hmm,
for basically the same kind of product. It was another brownfield project where the tanks and the jetties had already been constructed, and Chicago Bridge and Iron expected that they could do it for a price that would beat Bechtel. So fast forward a few years, that project is now 2 years behind schedule. And the latest numbers that we have seen from McDermott, because Chicago Bridge and Iron could not survive the cost of that contract, and confirmed by Kyoto, that was one of the partners, is that it's going to cost at least $600 a ton to build the same project, and that the loss on Cameron will be somewhere between $1.5 billion and $2 billion. And who exactly would bear that loss is not quite clear yet. And in addition, the visibility in terms of building trains 1, 2, and 3 for Cameron is still unclear until the cost overruns are resolved. So it's not a question simply of saying there is a guarantee and there is a lump sum turnkey contract. If already two or three contractors have to shore up their liquidity in order to be able to meet their obligations, if they can't do that, it does not help the project move forward, and therefore you lose total visibility on the delivery of those trains. So I think that gives you a pretty good picture in terms of what kind of trouble you can get yourself into if your project is not well conceived from the beginning. A $2 billion loss on a project of that magnitude is very significant for every player in that project.
Is there any way that you can think of a scenario where you can come in, meet your productivity measurements, i.e. come on time, deliver the project within a certain time frame that you've described while maintaining costs within check? Is that even feasible at this point, given your experience?
Well, Cheniere has done it 7 times. So yes, of course, it's feasible. It's just a question of culture and approach to the projects. Cheniere has always advocated that it's a collaborative process with your supplier. You don't bid the project and expect that the company that was trying to be the low bidder,
mm-hmm,
is going to be able to deal with all the contingencies with a fully priced project. You can have variations, and if you don't do the work carefully, you have to come back and revisit your cost picture. So we have selected a totally different approach when I was at Cheniere, and we wanted to bring in our contractor as a partner from the beginning, understand the costs and the issues and the problems and the contingencies together, provide for them, and make sure that we could deliver. So when we came up with the $500 ton contract, it was the result of 2 years worth of work with that contractor. Mm-hmm. And on that basis, I'm very happy to say that while I was there and after I left, Cheniere was able to always continue to deliver on time, on budget. It's a matter of approach.
Now, I guess one of the questions that we get here is that Bechtel has a great track record. But given that they're private versus the other EPC providers being public, how did you get comfortable around their ability to deliver these projects, their balance sheet, their, you know, availability to labor? Was there anything in particular, any insight you could share there?
The first thing is I know how to read the balance sheet.
That's helpful.
The second thing is that it's not just me. Mm-hmm. It is also all my banks,
yep,
all my equity providers, and Blackstone and EIG are not exactly amateurs in this particular context. So when we've passed muster with 22 banks and 3 or 4 different private equity providers, on top of all the different Shells and Totals and BGs that have come and looked and kicked the tires and understood the projects, the method and the players that were involved in that project have passed muster with a lot of people.
Got it.
And so we're very, very comfortable that Bechtel is the right partner for us and that the type of contract with them is sustainable. We would never put them in jeopardy. We would not accept that they take a risk that is not appropriate. We want to understand that the costs that we come up with together are achievable and are reasonable.
So you're saying that the hurdles or the, I guess, the diligence from the banks, from the third parties and investors that you've seen in the past, the thresholds are quite high, and perhaps it could be challenging for other second wave LNG projects to get through, and they're perhaps not fully pricing this risk?
I'm not saying that, because there is no magic to what we do. We simply mm-hmm. do our homework very well. And if anybody wants to duplicate the kind of work that we do, it's not difficult to do. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of approach, but it's also a matter of the fact that we don't skimp on getting the best people in the business. We now, 3 years into the program, have 200 people in our offices, dealing with all these complexities and all these issues. And we work as a collaboration with Bechtel. So we have engineers embedded with the Bechtel engineers. We look at everything. It's an open book process. It's easy to duplicate, but you just have to go and hire the right people to do it.
Okay.
You cannot do it with a short staff on the back of an envelope.
Got it. Let's shift to the discussion regarding the questions we got on the commercial and equity structure, if that's okay. I guess one of the things that we were hearing, or the feedback we're getting, is what could the potential bottlenecks or feedback that you're getting from the customers that are in the data room in the syndication process?
You have different potential partners that are looking at the data with a different angle. You've got the utilities around the world that people are traditionally thinking of natural buyers for a product like this. Mm-hmm. They are interested in low-cost gas on a global basis.
Okay.
And we provide them with low-cost gas on the water, mm-hmm. which is what they really focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you have American companies that are in a position where they have excess gas mm-hmm. and that they're trying to commercialize at the highest possible price.
Right.
So we have to combine two very different type of potential partners. And we're trying to figure out what is the common denominator between everybody in order to put a capital structure in place that respects the objectives of both types of buyers that we have.
Okay.
And this is the exercise that we're going through now. We've always said that we would have a very high degree of comfort of who our partners are going to be by the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And we are there. We know who our short list of preferred buyers. We whittle down the list from 25 people, 35 people at peak, to the people that we would like to have as potential partners that we're going to end up with. We're pretty close to having made our final short list, mm-hmm. at least for the first phase, which would be 3 trains.
Okay.
And we're trying to now make sure that we put a capital structure in place that responds to the issues of all type of buyers that we have.
Okay. I'm going to push back here a bit based on the feedback that I've got. Let's play devil's advocate and say, what would potentially cause an extension to the current timeline with regards to signing commercial agreements? And how should we think about how you balance preserving the value both on a cash flow basis and on the carried interest side of things with managing the timeline of signing commercial agreements?
So let me start with what is my real deadline. My real deadline is I expect to get the permits between February and March, and I won't be able to break ground between March and April.
Okay,
that's my real deadline. My second point is, what is my real concern? Okay, my real concern is I want the cash flow per share of Tellurian to be as high as possible, because that is my interest. Mm-hmm. I own 25% of Tellurian, and I own only 25% of Tellurian. I do not collect a salary. I do not have a bonus. I do not have an incentive plan. I have my equity share.
Right.
That is all I care about. What the market should focus on is the fact that I have indicated that I think what is available for the Tellurian shareholder is roughly $2 to $2.5 billion of free cash flow for the shareholders of Tellurian. And that is what I'm focused on. So I'm looking at trying to generate $8 of cash flow per share or better.
Okay.
So when you ask me what the bottlenecks are, they're not bottlenecks. What I'm trying to do is to make sure that the formula that I come up with to combine the different interests in our product result in having $8 a share or better of free cash flow for the Tellurian shareholder.
Okay, that's helpful. Another thing that we're hearing is that there's some concern that U.S. projects potentially would have to compete with uneconomic, and I use that in quotation marks, or projects that require a very low rate of return. How would you address this concern with regards to Tellurian marketing the solution we're providing here versus some of these projects globally that might be pushing the envelope in terms of return profile, given that they either have state-backed incentives or other dynamics which are requiring them to have a lower threshold on return?
The only country that can afford to do an economic project is Qatar. And since I know my Qatari friends fairly well, I don't really see them as embracing an economic projects. Having said this, everybody else that is a potential gas producer on a global basis has economic considerations, because they will look for partners to finance their projects. If they don't propose economic projects, they will not get funded. It's as simple as that.
Okay.
So you are not going to go to Mozambique with an uneconomic project, because you will not get the money to build it. You will not go to Russia with an uneconomic project, because you will not get the money to build it. And you will not go to East Med. You will not go to Tanzania. You will not go to Canada. Some people will make mistakes, but if you make the mistake, you make it once and you don't come back.
Do you think that there is some, from what you've seen globally from these various projects, is there a bookend or a range that you think is a reasonable, or call it a return profile for a typical liquefaction project or a new development, in your opinion?
I think the critical thing is to be in the top quartile of projects being developed, because we're going into a commodity market.
Mm-hmm. And you're referring on a top quartile on a cost basis?
On a cost basis.
Okay.
And for the top quartile on a cost basis, we think that the United States is as competitive as any other country in the world.
Got it.
Now, will we be the absolutely cheapest project? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But will we be in the top 25%? Absolutely.
Okay.
And that is based on very cheap gas in the United States and probably the most efficient liquefaction capacity to build, regardless of the problems that we may have in the United States, to get the gas on the water at the most competitive price possible. After that, it becomes an issue of your cost of capital that can be all over the place. It doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
But on a no cost of capital basis, the U.S. can deliver LNG on the water in the Gulf Coast for $2.50 and add on their cost of capital to the picture.
Okay.
And since we can build the liquefaction for $600 a ton or better,
mm-hmm.
It puts us in an extremely competitive position.
We've seen GE, they're one of our partners in our project, as well as investors in Tellurian. They've been in the headlines of late. Is there any updates or change in the relationship between Tellurian and GE at this point that are worth discussing at this point, or any material changes there from what you
know? Our relationship is with Baker Hughes.
Okay.
And therefore, I don't see any concern.
Okay. That was pretty easy. Another question we got was the level of conviction that you've seen from, I guess, customers. How has that changed? The customers that are in the data room that are looking at our project, how has that changed over the last 6 months in terms of their ability to sign commercial agreements? What's that conviction level and interest look like compared to 6 months
ago? I am still on the same page. When you get into a commodity business, you don't need to sign long-term commercial agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the business model has to be adjusted to the function that you are in a commodity business. There are strategic players on both sides, whether they own gas in America that they need to get rid of, or whether they need gas on a global basis, that are looking for the same thing that we are looking for, to be the low-cost provider of natural gas on a global basis. And three dozens of those came into our data room. A lot of them are still talking and still looking and still trying to understand the model. It's getting better. So in the last 6 months, more people have adopted this position that the old traditional models are not going to work anymore,
mm-hmm.
and that the industry needs to come up with something different. If you had to ask me today, what is that different 5 years down the road, you will have a world that is buying gas or selling gas on a JKM basis with different netbacks provided around the world. And while we wait for this, we have to be a little bit more creative.
Do you think that the recent sell-off in energy prices, specifically Brent and WTI, has a meaningful impact on the algorithm or commercial decision-making process of off-takers?
No. Again, it goes back to what I said before. You're going to have a world that is significantly more volatile because the nature of the beast between weather issues, technical issues and geopolitical issues. And we just have going to have to get used to a world where you can see a Brent at $60 one day, $85 three months later. And you have to get used to these kind of variations.
Okay. We had some pushback or I guess questions regarding the source and uses of capital within our integrated model, specifically tied to the upstream. I know we had some good discussions regarding this. It would be helpful to clarify again how you're thinking about the use of capital to acquire upstream within the integrated model. The purpose, what does it serve? What purpose does it serve? There perhaps is some, there are different views regarding that use of that capital. Some have mentioned that there's better uses of that capital instead of acquiring upstream acreage. Can you talk a bit about that and what's your philosophy and thoughts around that?
Well, I think the perfect model does not exist. Therefore, there will always be times where your model shows that you made a mistake, and it's a temporary mistake. And you just have to accept it. So you're buying optionality. You're not buying certainty. I think it's very hard to say that the Waha Basin basis is going to be better forever over the next 40 years. It looks really good today. Mm-hmm. When we FID'd Corpus Christi, it didn't look so good.
Right.
So you have to live with these variations. So you're looking today at the South Louisiana market, and you're saying Perryville may be under pressure a year or two from now, or maybe not. Or it depends on whether the infrastructure is built or not. So you have to combine the three components that we've highlighted in our Tellurian presentations, which is you're looking at three different risk factors very carefully, and you're trying to adjust for all three of them. One is construction. We've dealt with that pretty well. One is basis. We've been very fortunate until now that basis has not hurt us. And the third one is basin. And if you end up buying gas in the wrong basin, it can become very expensive. So you have to give yourself optionality on those three, which by definition means that from time to time you will be wrong on one of them or on two of them. But overall, it's a hedge. So the upstream position today, when Henry Hub is now over $4, looks very good. Will it be sustained over the next 40 years? I'm fairly sure no. But the abundance of gas also depends on oil prices, because if in the Permian Basin oil prices don't stay over $50 a barrel, maybe the production in the Permian Basin will be curtailed. You have to take all these things into consideration today. So we think it's critical to have a natural hedge by owning some production, or at least owning resources in the ground, and produce only when you need to produce. That I think, and when you look at the numbers in terms of what percentage of your total capital outlay is going to be dedicated to production at this stage of the game, it's less than 5%, so it really is not significant in the overall picture.
Okay. Let's move on to another topic. Could you share some of your thoughts regarding our friends at Total and their announcement with Sempra? How you're thinking about that announcement there? Any other thoughts you have on their EPC provider or just... timeline around that project?
Well, the first thing that I would say in terms of the Sempra project in Cameroon is that Tellurian and Driftwood by themselves, or Cheniere, Tellurian and Driftwood, are not enough to deal with the excess of gas that is going to be available in the United States, let alone deal with the demand that is going to come from various places that actually need the gas desperately. Mm-hmm. So having another project that is successful is not a major issue. I think we're going to need more than a few projects in order to deal with the fundamental issues we have both in this country and around the rest of the world. Having said this, it's hard for me to take seriously an announcement of projects that would talk about trains 4 and 5 when trains 1, 2, and 3 have not been resolved, have no visibility, and have not been delivered. So I think what I will do is wait to see how the losses of the construction companies are dealt with, have some more visibility on when the first 2 or 3 trains are going to be delivered at Cameroon before I get excited about an MOU that promises to work with each other in the future when we resolve all of our current issues. So with all due respect, I don't take this very seriously. If it happens, it's needed. If it doesn't happen, there's no point in getting concerned about it today.
Okay. Final question here. There was some disclosures From our end, you acquired some Telerian stock. Could you care to comment a bit on that and how you're thinking about that here?
Well, Amit, I bought some stock in the $7 range, which is less than what I expect the cash flow per share to be in 3 years.
Right.
So it's a gift. I found myself not able to resist it.
Fair enough. That makes a lot of sense. On that note, is there anything else you wanted to leave here in terms of our conversation that we potentially missed on or didn't discuss, in your opinion?
I founded with Martin Telerian in February of 2016. And we have not finished our third year yet. There's still 3 months to go.
Right.
I could not be prouder of the work that our group has put together and the project that they've created. So this time, there's been very little improvisation. We've gone very methodically about conducting our business. With all the lessons that Martin and I and our teams had learned from our previous experiences, and the outcome is exactly what we were hoping for. So I'm delighted at the results where we are today. I am grateful for the work that has been produced by all our teams, by 200 colleagues today that we have here. And we expect, with the current administration, the permit to be granted in the first quarter of next year. So far, they're granting the permits on an accelerated schedule. So I'm extremely optimistic.
Okay. On that note, Sharif, thank you for your time. Thank you to our audience for tuning in and our partners that have taken us out in the last little while. We appreciate the time. Talk to you soon.
Confidential notice. This page includes links to videos that include statements made by officers and directors of Telerian Inc., the company, and other persons. The company assumes no responsibility for statements made by persons other than its officers, directors, and other authorized spokespersons. Statements made by the company's representatives may include forward-looking statements regarding, among other things, commodity prices, regulatory and operational developments, future economic conditions, and other matters. Such forward-looking statements are subject to numerous risks and uncertainties, including the risk of unanticipated changes in market, regulatory, or business environments and other risks described in the company's filings with the SEC, which are available on the site under Investors, Financials, Filings, and Presentations. The company does not undertake to update such forward-looking statements, which are made only as of the date indicated.